July 29th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Fedor.
And we have... Hey, Pam! We have arrived in somewhere. Would you like to tell us where we have arrived?
We have arrived in the Valley of Fear. Finally, we're here.
Finally. We've been hearing about this valley for so long, and we've now arrived in the Valley of Fear.
There's roller coasters and cotton candy. We're going to have a great time. There's all sorts of shit.
Yes, as we find from the opening of this chapter, it is pretty much a theme park. It was the 4th of February in the year 1875. It had been a severe winter, and the snow lay deep in the gorges of the Gilmerton Mountains. The steam plows had, however, kept the railroad open, and the evening train, which connects the long line of coal mining and ironworking settlements, was slowly groaning its way up the steep gradients, which lead from Stagville on the plain to Vermissa, the central township which lies at the head of Vermissa Valley. From this point, the track sweeps downward to Barton's Crossing, Helmdale, and the purely agricultural county of Merton. It was a single-track railroad, but at every siding, and there were numerous, long lines of trucks piled with coal and iron ore told of the hidden wealth which had brought a rude population and a bustling life to this most desolate corner of the United States of America. For desolate it was.
What is interesting about this is Doyle has spent a lot of effort to create this valley. And he's used Chicago, he's used the Carolinas and Atlanta, he's used real locations. But this is a made-up area, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And absolutely.
And the stage is very well set here in this first paragraph. We would be remiss not to have read that whole paragraph, because this is great narrative. This is well-designed.
And let me put this in perspective also. 1875, so we're about 10 years after the Civil War. And, we're coming up on the Industrial Revolution.
Desolate it was.
Desolate it was. And we have this this notion of the train, the importance of the train, which is connecting to all those urban centers, those real urban centers that he has mentioned, which are bringing energy, right, in the form of coal or iron ore, bringing energy to the cities. But we don't very often look at where that energy is coming from, what kind of people are involved in the mining operations, the manufacturing operations that occur in these less well-known places, like these big Pennsylvania valleys.
Mm-hmm. Not until the coal miner's daughter.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
A little Loretta Lynn. But that comes in, I think it's like 1930s when she was born. So it doesn't look like it's going to progress that much more than where we are now by the time Loretta Lynn is born.
So this chapter is titled The Man, and we get a view here.
You can tell everybody.
This is your song?
I'm the man. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes. You're the man.
Yeah, I think it's funny because as we're introduced to the train, like we see the train from the outside, then we get inside and see who's inside the train. And then the narrator says, "Take a good look at him, for he is worth it." And this, of course, is written by Mr. Douglas, right? As we're just sort of reminded, this isn't Watson writing. This is Mr. Douglas's tale.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I had neglected to notice whose writing this was. This was always Doyle in my head, but you're right. This is Mr. Douglas scrawling
this,
scrawling all this story down in his little hidey hole for 2 days.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is this is a total a different type of introduction than what Watson would give us.
Exactly. Exactly. So take a look at this guy. He is worth it. He is a fresh complexioned, middle-sized young man, not far, one would guess, from his 30th year. He has large, shrewd, humorous gray eyes, which twinkle inquiringly from time to time as he looks round through his spectacles at the people about him. It is easy to see that he is of a sociable and possibly simple disposition, anxious to be friendly to all men. Anyone could pick him at once as gregarious in his habits and communicative in his nature, with a quick wit and a ready smile. And yet the man who studied him more closely might discern a certain firmness of jaw and grim tightness about the lips, which would warn him that there were depths beyond, than that this pleasant brown-haired young Irishman might conceivably leave his mark for good or evil upon any society to which he was introduced.
Hmm.
It's a lengthy description, and I think Doyle has done a good job of making it quite different from Watson's writing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no comparison to animals. There's, you know, this is a very almost, this is almost like a police blotter version.
Hmm.
Eyes, his jaw, his hair color, his lineage, he's Irish. And there's this sense he could go for good or evil, this guy. We don't really know who he is.
And we're getting a little bit of that throughout this chapter. We're going to be introduced, and he's going to be this pleasant, lovely guy. And then right after that, another group comes in, and he is certainly going to be a very agitated type of conversation that will take place. So he certainly is identifying properly, because we get both parts of it.
I love your use of the word agitated, Chip, because we will be wondering at some point, is this man an agitator?
We get a great description of this character. This is a very complex character right there in that first paragraph. The dichotomy of this ready smile and quick wit is juxtaposed with the very next paragraph where he is armed and ready for danger. It was a Navy revolver of the largest size. As he turned it slantwise in the light, the glint upon the rims of the copper shells within the drum showed that it was fully loaded. He quickly restored it to his secret pocket, but not before it had been observed by a working man who had seated himself upon the adjoining bench. Wow.
This guy is a little deeper than you first thought, just as the opening paragraph
and
suggests.
Doyle uses a color in his description, therefore it's good description. We get our secret society here. There is a conversation between these two men, one armed and the other one being very suspicious. There's a secret handshake and a call and reply, the favorite of the secret societies.
So
should we read a little dialogue here? It's kind of really wonderful, tight dialogue.
Absolutely.
Who's going to play the parts? Okay.
You're asking me to read. Oh,
yeah, Chip, read that. I'll read the first line. You read the second line.
Here
ready?
We go. Let me get my stuff on.
Oh, boy.
All right, here we go. Handshakes, the call and reply. Are you a member of the union?
Sure.
Then you'll get your job, I guess. Have you any friends?
Not yet, but I have the means of making them.
How's that, then?
I am one of the eminent order of free men. There's no town without a lodge, and where there's a lodge, I'll find my friends.
Is this the water buffalo?
This is the Loyal Order of Water Buffalo. This is the secret society America is teeming with, apparently, in Doyle's view.
Well, the Masons certainly were very known. And then there are all sorts of other fraternities, if you want me to go through it. But anyway, a lot of them played insurance. They were the insurance of the time, too. Mm-hmm. So you had your connections and you had your protection.
And then you get descriptions of other people on the train. I kind of like right after where you guys ended. The remark had a singular effect upon his companion. He glanced around suspiciously at the others in the car. The miners were still whispering among themselves. The two police officers were dozing. He came across, seated himself close to the young traveler, and held out his hand.
Put it there, he said. A hand grip passed between the two.
I see you speak the truth, but it's well to make certain. And he raised his right hand to his right eyebrow. The traveler at once raised his left hand to his left eyebrow.
Dark nights are unpleasant, said the workman.
Yes, for strangers to travel.
Ah, that's good enough. I'm Brother Scanlon, Lodge 341, Vermissa Valley. Glad to see you in these parts.
I'm Brother John McMurdo, Lodge 29, Chicago.
Chicago. John McMurdo, Chicago.
Chicago.
So you guys, so this is really interesting, right? Because these two guys, they do the secret handshake. They've got the call and respond. password. You know, they've got all this stuff. And in the meantime, right next to them are two sleeping police officers. I just want to note. Mm-hmm. And at this time, of course, 1870s, we do have police on all the trains. That's just part of the travel arrangement, is because trains were considered a bit dangerous. You do have police on every train, but they're fast asleep.
So we very quickly get the story tied to the case here. Scanlon says, "There's one bit of advice I'll give you before we part. If you're in trouble in Vermissa, go straight to the Union House and see Boss McGinty. He's the bodymaster of Vermissa Lodge, and nothing can happen in these parts unless Black Jack McGinty wants it." Dun, dun, dun.
Black Jack McGinty. There's mm-hmm. your...
We know Bodymaster McGinty, uh-huh. right? From the Valley of Fear. Oh, yeah, we do.
Compared to Studying Scarlet, where it took chapters to finally match the names to the names of the first part, here Doyle is giving us, this is the story, here are the characters.
Exactly. So we have this lovely fraternity moment where they're like speaking, calling, little call and response. And then the next conversation, you know, is a little more challenged.
Yeah, a kindly policeman, one of the two that were dozing, approaches McMurdo and offers some simple advice. And McMurdo has a very quick, strong reaction to this conversation.
So the cop says, "Just this, mister, that I should advise you to be careful in choosing your friends. I don't think I'd begin with Mike Scanlon or his gang if I were you." "What the hell is it to you who are my friends?" roared McMurdo in a voice which brought every head in the carriage round to witness the altercation. "Did I ask you for your advice, or did you think me such a sucker that I couldn't move without it? You speak when you are spoken to, and by the Lord, you'd have to wait a long time if it was me." He thrust out his face and grinned at the patrolman like a snarling dog. Oof. There it is. First zoomorphism.
Did Pam master the Chicago accent, Steve?
Now, remember, this is an Irishman. This is an Irishman who was in Chicago. He is not a Chicagoan. He is an Irishman. Okay. So she did great.
I simply did not attempt an Irish accent, shall I.
No, that's one of the toughest accents.
No, but did you guys notice he used the word sucker, which is totally American? So,
okay.
By thunder, I did.
He called the police cops. And so he is using a lot of American terms. And then if I can just read a little bit further, it's quite interesting. The two policemen, heavy, good-natured men, were taken aback by the extraordinary vehemence with which their friendly advances had been rejected. "No offense, stranger," said one. "It was a warning for your own good, seeing that you are, by your own showing, new to the place." "I'm new to the place, but I'm not new to you and your kind," cried McMurdo in cold fury. "I guess you're the same in all places, shoving your advice in when nobody asks for it." Oof. Before he had set foot in it, McMurdo the Turbulent had become a character in Vermissa.
Wow.
So what's going on here? How do you... This rather extraordinary, as the narrative says, this extraordinary vehemence that this... you know, apparently gregarious young 30-year-old man displays towards these police officers who, by all accounts, seem to be just friendly guys.
He's a good guy, he's a bad guy. We don't know yet.
This is a pretty violent turn and pretty instant here. He obviously has a pretty big chip on his shoulder about police and about, you know, the history that he has with the police, especially in Chicago, which is, wow. He's come armed and he's got a chip on his shoulder and he has an emotional reaction to these very nice police officers.
And he obviously doesn't mind everybody knowing it because he has raised his voice so that everyone in the train carriage is looking at them.
Nothing like putting a target on your back. Oh, we should keep a lookout for this guy.
Yes, I think that a report should be filed about this guy for sure.
And then we move from the inside of the train back outside when we arrive at the Vermissa Valley landscape. And again, I think this description is really great. The country had been a place of terror. But the town was in its way even more depressing. down that long valley, there was at least a certain gloomy grandeur in the huge fires and the clouds of drifting smoke, while the strength and industry of man found fitting monuments in the hills, which he had spilled by the side of his monstrous excavations. But the town showed a dead level of mean ugliness and squalor. The broad street was churned up by the traffic into a horrible rutted paste of muddy snow. The sidewalks were narrow and uneven. The numerous gas lamps served only to show more clearly a long line of wooden houses, each with its veranda facing the street, unkempt and dirty. Hmm. This is a place of squalor and poverty from which all of that energy is coming. And that notion of the monstrous excavations, this idea, I mean, maybe this is a 21st century eco-critical look, but you get that idea of the sort of really unethical mining practices that happen today in Pennsylvania with fracking. And at this time, with the type of coal mining that's being done, this description seems a bit judgment laden to me. What do you guys think?
Well, coal, I'm familiar more with West Virginia, and West Virginia has a couple things that they sell. They sell their natural beauty, the mountains and how beautiful it is. And then there's the strip mining that goes on, and where they go in and they have to extract the coal and stuff like that, which certainly upsets the natural beauty. So, you know, they need money. They need to be able to survive. So they're selling this coal, which is the energy of its time. And at the same time, it's also upsetting the land, I guess, the natural beauty. But mm-hmm. one of the things I'm going to notice about this, I think this is showing, this is a town that had to be put up very quickly.
Yes.
Because it had to. So that means that not everything is really thought out. You need some sidewalks put down. Well, this is what we have. Let's put them down. You know, it's not really, the people are coming there. They don't really have a lot. Why? Because, I mean, who is choosing to be a coal miner? A person who's basically, they either love the adventure of it, or they just need the revenue. And so there's all sorts of, you know, other challenges going on. This is, looks like a city that was kind of slapped together. It's of its time. It hasn't had time to mature and grow to what a modern town would have.
And I would say in the 1870s, if you wanted adventure, you would go to California or Alaska for gold mining. I mean, coal mining, it doesn't have that excitement, right? This is labor, straight up.
But the money is good for the people who have nothing at the time.
It's something, but team that with the mean ugliness and squalor in this paragraph. I mean, this is unkempt and dirty. This is not a way to live.
Well, Steve, coal mining is dirty. Mm-hmm. It's not you're going into into a mountain. It's warm. It's hot. You're sweaty. You work all day and you come out and you wash up the best you can. It's not like you have all this time afterwards to go and fix up a house or something like that.
Right.
It is by definition. And who was doing this work? Well, these are poor people. Mm-hmm. You know, they've come across, many of them, I'm sure, have come across from Europe. They're trying to make their way. They're trying to have a better life. They left poverty and they've come to an area just kind of, this is like I said, a new area. It's poor and the industry is a dirty industry.
And it's also driven through by crime is another thing that we learn. So another kindly miner shows McMurdo to his destination. He's going to be staying at the Shafter home. And as they walk over there, this guy starts talking a little bit about the dark underbelly of this already visibly dark area. He says, if killing is murder, which is kind of a funny way to start, mm-hmm. if killing is murder, then God knows there is murder and to spare. But don't you dare to breathe the name of Jack McGinty in connection with its stranger, for every whisper goes back to him, and he is not one that is likely to let it pass. So we get another kind of strange warning to McMurdo here as he's going to the place where he'll be staying, that there is murder in this valley, and it mostly goes back to Bodymaster McGinty.
Setting the scene. This is mm-hmm. this is very much a different story than the story that we read. The fun that we had with the mystery is very different from the darkness that we are seeing in the setup for the backstory.
And it seems like McGinty must be the enforcer of the area. Mm-hmm. So whatever he's enforcing.
Mm-hmm. Blackjack McGinty. Mm-hmm.
Body master, Blackjack McGinty. Mm-hmm. Whose body is he at the master of? Not mine, thank God, said Douglas in our previous So now, when McMurdo arrives at Mr. Shafter's, we get another genre thrown in, right? We're kind of in the hard-boiled American detective genre. Now, oh my, the door was opened at once by someone very different from what he had expected. It was a woman, young and singularly beautiful. She was of the German type, blonde and fair-haired, with the piquant contrast of a pair of beautiful dark eyes with which she surveyed the stranger with surprise and a pleasing embarrassment, which brought a wave of color upon her pale face. I'm Miss Etty Shafter, Mr. Shafter's daughter. My mother's dead, and I run the house.
Isn't that an interesting start? Isn't that an interesting start? Hi, I'm Etty. My mom's dead. Wait, what? How did...
I know.
Okay.
She is but a Fräulein, Steve.
I love the pleasing embarrassment. That, boy, is that a great turn of phrase.
You can picture a little blush to her cheek. Mm-hmm. Ooh, there's a man at the door.
But that's pleasing. That is two words put together in that way. This is great narrative.
Isn't that saying somewhat maybe of a charm? Yeah.
Charming.
Lovely. It really is a nice phrase.
Yep.
So we get a little romance thrown in here, my friends.
Cue the romance music.
And we know that there is a German ex-wife, a dead German wife that's in this story somewhere. So we need to discover who these people are in our mystery.
Which brings us to the end of this chapter, chapter one of The Scourers. A heavy elderly man came plodding up the path. In a few words, McMurdo explained his business. A man of the name of Murphy had given him the address in Chicago. He, in turn, had had it from someone else. Old Shafter was quite ready. The stranger made no bones about terms, agreed at once to every condition, and was apparently fairly flush of money. For $7 a week paid in advance, he was to have board and lodging. So it was that McMurdo, the self-confessed fugitive from justice, took up his abode under the roof of the Shafters, the first step which was to lead to so long and dark a train of events, ending in a far distant land. End of chapter. So you guys, what do you think of this chapter? It's such a contrast, right, from the first half of the novel, but give me your impressions.
He certainly has changed voice as far as Doyle has for the writing. And it is a departure from the Sherlock Holmes stories as we know them. So I like the setup. Now I'm interested in learning more.
I absolutely am intrigued by the setup here. This is set up so well. I question again, like I did in The Study in Scarlet, whether we should have gotten this first or if we needed the more cheeky mystery first in order to get to this dark place. And I think that that was the right choice because I'm not sure that I was intrigued. I'm not sure that I would have been intrigued enough by this dark scene without the very fun mystery that we just got through in the first part.
And now I just want to give you a little bit of background here. So this, the Scourers section is based on historical data from the American 1870s. And we'll talk a little bit more as we learn a little bit more. So there's a lot of debate about the construction of the Valley of Fear, how Arthur Conan Doyle got the idea for it, and who really owns the idea for it. There's a biography of Alan Pinkerton, the very famous American detective, Sigmund Levine's biography, that claims that, and I'll read it, Alan Pinkerton, the real detective, clashed with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of the most famous detective of fiction, Sherlock Holmes, over one of his books. Alan sued Sir Arthur, claiming that he had obtained the plot for his The Valley of Fear from Pinkerton's The Molly Maguires and the Detectives. And this is one of the really big biographies of Pinkerton, and there are a number of different ones. And so when I was studying Pinkerton many years ago, I thought, wait, that's really weird. Because it turns out that Alan Pinkerton had been dead for 30 years when The Valley of Fear was published. He died in the 1880s. So that's actually not true at all. But that is sort of this idea that Doyle might have stolen the story. And it turns out, much more accurately, in 1914, Doyle was taking a steamer to America, the SS Olympic, and who he met was Alan Pinkerton's son, William Pinkerton. And he told Doyle about the Molly Maguires, and that's what got Doyle writing this book. And so then there were some discussions about a lawsuit, but the lawsuit never actually happened. And according to Pinkerton Agency's manager in the 1915-16, he said, Mr. Doyle sent several notes trying to soothe things over. And while William Allen Pinkerton sent him courteous replies, he never regarded Mr. Doyle with the same warmth afterwards. Oh, there is this notion that the American portion of this book is a little bit misbegotten in terms of not having proper acknowledgement for taking the story from the Pinkertons. I just love the idea of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who I just think has had such an amazing impact on detective fiction, and Alan Pinkerton's son, who has had such a huge impact on American detective fiction. I love the idea of them like smoking cigars in the smoking room of the SS Olympic and talking about detective fiction and what it looks like in America versus in Britain. And that's really what we're getting here in this split novel, right? The Valley of Fear, that's showing us different models of British detection. And now that we get to the American portion, we're going to get different models of American detection. We've already met these police officers and see the way that they're treated compared to how Holmes treats Inspector Mack and White Mason. So
is Doyle attempting to write like it's an American?
Sure. Okay. Yeah, like we can see the different style that he's taking on.
Sure, okay. Yeah. Okay.
And thinking of it in the handwriting of Douglas is intriguing to me. I hadn't thought of that when I was reading this. And since you said that at the beginning of this show, I was like, wow, yeah, this is an American-ish voice giving us this American tale. And it is very different from the first part of the story.
Over the course of reading all of these stories, you also mentioned that Mark Twain had written Pastiche.
The double-barreled detective story, which is a total satire of Sherlock Holmes.
Okay. So he was an American writer attempting to satire a British writer.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is
a time of great tension, right, between the U.S. and the U.K. Absolutely.
Because the Cubs won the World Series like 7 years before this.
That's exactly why.
it was a tough time for the Cubs.
It all comes down to baseball. It is absolutely right.
Who would have known they would have had to wait over 100 years for the next championship?
That's right. This is great. I am intrigued by this mystery. I hope that everybody else out there is thinking about these issues. And thank you, Pam, for being the expert and coming in and explaining the things that we would not have known. Your depth of knowledge of Pinkertons and the detective novels of the 19th century is amazing, and I just sit at your feet and you can profess all you want on this show, Pam.
Stuff is so much fun though, isn't it?
Oh,
like, this period is so fascinating in both the US and the UK, and this is what I love about The Valley of Fear, is that it brings together these two really different forms of detection and detective fiction.
And the beauty of this also is our next chapter reminds us we should all work out before reading it.
Indeed. Ah, the body master.
Jack LaLanne. Black Jack LaLanne. I hope everybody is still with us and listening carefully and reading carefully and enjoying this still. I'm super, super happy to bring this to you each morning. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Send us an email. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all the feedback from around the world. And go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of these great conversations. Join us tomorrow as we get into Chapter 9 of The Valley of Freya. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedore, welcoming you at last to The Valley of Freya.